Call the next case.
Commonwealth Expert Lawyer versus Sweetheart Institute and others. Elizabeth Ellen Boyer, William Henry Hurd, Ashley Miles Taylor, George Arnold Somerville, Peter Charles Keithgrass, Nancy Owen Keene, Appellant's Counsel, Helen W. Fowler Jr., Nathaniel T. Connolly III, Joseph Ray Pope, Harold Edward Johnson, Jonathan Hardy-Weekier, and Faculty Counsel.
May it please the Court, I'm William Hurd here today on behalf of the Commonwealth Sexrel Ellen Boyer, County Attorney of Amherst County. With me at council table are the County Attorney, Ellen Boyer, and George Somerville. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of time for rebuttal. We are here today to ask you for a temporary injunction to prevent the closing of Sweetbriar College and to direct the trial court to appoint a special fiduciary to operate the college in Unite Lite. As a practical matter, we're asking you for the chance to let us save Sweetbriar College. And please, every day, every week that goes by, more students leave, more faculty leave, and without prompt action by this court to keep the college open, it will be very difficult to save the college, even if we win the lawsuit at the end of the day. We have presented two claims as the basis for a temporary injunction, first being brought under the Charitable Solicitations Act, the second under the Uniform Trust Code. Under the first claim, the trial court read too narrowly the scope of its authority and thus gave us an injunction that limits the funds that can be used to close the college but does not prevent closure. Under the second claim, the trial court mistakenly believed that a corporation cannot also be a trustee, and thus gave us no relief at all under that count. The trial court erred with respect to the trust issue because it misread the Dodge case. That case happens to have been my case, so I'm very familiar with it, and the case does not say that a charitable corporation cannot be a trustee. The claim in Dodge was that Randolph-Macon Women's College, which was not previously a trustee, was transformed into a trustee by the passage of 2.2-507.1. This court rejected that claim and said 507.1 merely gave additional authority to the Attorney General. Dodge is inapplicable here for two reasons. First, we do not rely on 507.1 to say that Sweetbriar Institute is a trustee. We rely instead on the 1901 Act of the General Assembly and the will of Indiana Fletcher Williams. We had nothing like that in the Dodge case. Second, nowhere does Dodge say that a non-stock corporation can never be a trustee. It does say that Randolph-Macon Women's College is not a trustee, but does not say that no corporation can ever be a trustee. In fact, this court has said just the opposite of that. In the JoCo case, this court quoted Scott on Trust for this proposition, quote, "It cannot be stated dogmatically that a charitable corporation either is or is not a trustee," end quote. So then, how do you tell? Well, here's what the court said in the broadest case we quote in our petition at page 9. Quote, "Trusts are, as we know, frequently created without the use of technical words," close quote. Respondents admit this on page 12 of their brief. Instead, a trust can be created by, again, this is from Broadus, and I'll paraphrase, "any words that show an intention that the legal estate be vested in one person to be held in some manner or form or some purpose on behalf of another person."
Mr. Hurd, may I ask you a question? Likelihood of success in the merits is one of the equitable variables, right, for preliminary injunction. Not the only, but one. If the court were to agree with you and conclude that there was a legal error made in the interpretation of trust law and the Charitable Solicitation Act, that would certainly change the ratio of win-loss guesswork on likelihood of success on merits, but I don't know that it would affect the other variables. So this all leads up to this question. Is the right end game for the appellate court to rule on what you're arguing and what the appellees are suggesting and then take the injunction or not on ourselves, or is it to remand it back to the chancellor to decide what to do with the proper legal standard?
We believe that the court has the discretion to go either route, but we also would emphasize that the time is of the essence here. There are important deadlines coming up at the end of this month. Going past those deadlines without some swift action to keep the college open will be another huge blow to our ability to save Sweetbriar College.
So what exactly would you ask for if we did agree with you in your temporary injunction?
We would ask these things. We would ask first that the court decide that Sweetbriar Institute is a trustee subject to the Uniform Trust Code. Second, we would ask that this court remand to the trial court with instructions for the trial court to appoint immediately a special fiduciary to operate the college, keeping it open, unless and until they can demonstrate that it is not financially possible to do so. We don't think they can make that demonstration, but we would leave that door open so that they would not be able to claim, well, somehow that their hands are being tied and things are going to go downhill and all of that. Special fiduciary would be able not only to operate the college in a way that is free from the respondent's predetermined view that it should be shut down. The special fiduciary would also be able to report to the trial court and explain the true status of the college finances, and we believe, undergird the evidence already in the record, that this is not a college that is doomed to failure.
The one risk we have is getting ahead of ourselves. This is a preliminary injunction. This is not a final injunction. We can't decide the ultimate merits on all these issues now. We shouldn't. Am I right?
Yes, Your Honor, but if we're truly to preserve the status quo, which means conditions as they were before the controversy arose, before March 3rd, then that means having the college open. In order to guarantee that the college is open, then did they lie to
you? I thought you asked for that from the trial court, and you don't seem to be asking for us to do that except through this fiduciary.
Well, no, actually, that would be, if you will, a fallback. Our preference would be a fiduciary appointed to operate the college, which implies keeping it open.
Okay.
If this court is not prepared to go that far, then we would ask for an order directing respondents to be the ones with a hand on the helm to operate the college.
Is your request for the appointment of a fiduciary such that it implicitly involves the removal of the trustees currently and the president, etc.? Or do they report to a fiduciary in your world?
We think the actual removal would be very nice, but we don't think it's necessary. We think that what's important is that a fiduciary be in charge, that he take directions not from the board and not from the president, but take his directions instead from the court, with the understanding that he is to operate the college.
Counsel, let me take you back to your analysis of Dodge. Under the test that you would have us apply to determine whether it's a corporation or a trust, it seems that Randolph-Macon College in Dodge satisfied some of the same requirements that Sweetbriar satisfies, benefit for the benefit of the college students, et cetera, et cetera. So if Randolph-Macon College was not a trust under your test, why does that dictate that Sweetbriar should be?
Justice Powell, first, to clarify, we are not opposing this false dichotomy corporation or trustee. It is both. Randolph Macon was not both. Sweetbriar is both. We have here, in the Sweetbriar case, facts that were not present in the Randolph Macon case. I read a moment ago what is necessary to create a trust. Any words that show an intention that the legal estate be vested in one person and held for some purpose on behalf of another. Well, look at the will of Indiana Fletcher Williams and the statute that required the corporation to comply.
Would your test override the provisions of the will if I read the will to provide that they direct the trustees to establish a corporation?
The directive of the trustees to establish a corporation, the General Assembly, of course, established a corporation. Then the question becomes, is that corporation a trustee?
Mm-hmm.
And that question is answered in the affirmative, because that corporation was instructed by the General Assembly and by the will that the General Assembly told the corporation to follow. That corporation was vested with the legal estate, the legal ownership, the property of Indiana Fletcher Williams. Legal ownership was here, but not for the benefit of the corporation. The equitable benefit was for the students.
Counsel, can I get you to go back to Randolph Macon a little bit and draw the distinction? Randolph Macon, was there in fact a trust, and the Randolph Macon were not trustees, or was there not even a trust in Randolph Macon?
No, there was no trust in Randolph Macon.
Okay.
There was no will creating Randolph Macon the way there was in Sweetbriar. There was no statute creating Randolph
Macon. It's just a charitable corporation is what you're going on.
Yes, Your Honor. And our argument was, okay, it used to be just a charitable corporation, but then the enactment of 507.1 said that assets held by charitable corporations are deemed to be held in trust.
Okay.
And that was the genesis of the argument, the failed argument, that it was trustee. We're not relying upon that statute here again. We're relying upon the basic formula for what it takes to create a trust, legal ownership here for the benefit of these people over here. And that's what the will of Indiana Fletcher Williams did, and that's what the statute, the Act of Assembly of 1901, did when it said, corporation, you take ownership of this property, and you use it to establish, maintain, and carry on a school for the education of girls and young women. That is a classic definition, classic pattern of how you create a trust. And of course, you don't have to use the words trust to create a trust. We all agree on that. Last time around, when Sweetbriar Institute was involved in major litigation, it was in the U.S. Supreme Court, where they went and told that court they were a trustee under the will and under the statute. They told the Supreme Court of the United States they were a trustee. And they were right.
At the same time, they were a corporation.
At the same time, yes, Your Honor, they were a corporation. So how can they tell the U.S. Supreme Court they're a trustee, and now when it's convenient, tell this court they're not?
Well, that has a motive appeal, but it's not analytically relevant.
You are cutting into your rebuttal time, did you know?
I appreciate that. I will save plenty of time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Woody Fowler. I'm with Williams Mullen, counsel for the respondents. With me, counsel Taylor, Al Johnson. Your Honors, I think it would be a good idea to look at the procedure and where we stand in this case. There have been two critical hearings. One was on April 14th, and it was a hearing on some preliminary motions, including a demur. The demur was granted. The demur was granted as to count two, the count that addressed the Virginia Uniform Trust Code Act. It was dismissed with prejudice. There was an order specific to that ruling regarding the demur that is an order that's entered on the 15th. On the 15th, there's also an evidentiary hearing that relates specifically to the temporary injunction. There was a granted in part, denied in part, and then on the 28th, there was an order entered for that. The Virginia Uniform Trust Code should not be properly before this court.
Well, counsel, let me interrupt you about that because I know where you're going. If that's correct, then any time you had a case that had a demur to the pleadings, as well as a motion for temporary injunction, if the trial court resolved the demur first, we could never get to the injunction if we had to resolve that issue before we could talk about the injunction. Is that the way the law should work?
Well, but you do have that opportunity, because under 8.01, 670.1, you could file an interlocutory appeal, where if it was a final order, you could go through the final order process. But the statute...
But that's just it. It is not a final order technically, but practically, as you point out, it's a final order on that count. But if it were truly a final technical order, you could get a post-judgment supersedis bond and a status quo injunction so that you could, if you lost that in the trial court, you can come to this court and complain about it. Why wouldn't, as Justice Mims points out, that same procedural remedy be theoretically available with a account that's been shot down at the pleading stage as opposed to shot down at the evidentiary stage?
I don't think you can bootstrap the failure to plead a viable cause of action with a ruling on the merits as to whether you're entitled to a temporary injunction or not. If they wanted to do that appeal, they could have run on parallel courses. They could have filed the 626 appeal relating to the granting and denying, in this case denying of the injunction, while also going under 670.1 in order to ask for an interlocutory appeal regarding the ruling on the demur. They had that option, and they could have moved along on the fast track so that we don't have a problem.
I'm sure you've been following our discussions we've had recently that we're trying to expand the jurisdiction of the court to on these temporary appeals of these temporary injunctions to make it a fair process. And this seems to almost fit right within that.
If there wasn't another remedy, if there wasn't another way to bring this before the court, I would agree with you. Also, though, we've got a couple of other issues with the Virginia Uniform Trust Code. First of all, the claim is brought by the county attorney. The attorney general has exclusive authority to assert this claim. If you look at the Virginia Uniform Trust Code, provision after provision after provision, it's the attorney general. There is never a mention of the county attorney anywhere. And that's different from 5759, where you have got a specific individual who's not an officer of the Commonwealth, but who is identified for the purposes of enforcing a statute.
If the attorney general has the exclusive standing, why does the statute say, among others?
Exclusive standing to represent the Commonwealth. Among others does have to have some meaning, Your Honor, and I would suggest that if you read back, you read restatement, you read Uniform Trust Code, that you're probably talking about private parties with a personal interest. That's usually where the cases and the commentary takes you. But she has filed on behalf of the Commonwealth, and she is not entitled to file on behalf of the Commonwealth. Only the Attorney General can enforce Uniform Trust Code on behalf of the Commonwealth. We also have the issue of, is this, in fact, governed by the Uniform Trust Code? The language, in my view, couldn't be any clearer. Mr. Hurd cited the broadest case. The broadest case says you have to have language that unequivocally shows the intent to form a trust. In our situation, we have a will and then a charter. The will devised Williams' property to four individuals as trustees and directed those trustees to procure the corporation of a corporation be called Sweetbriar Institute. The corporation shall be formed. The affairs of the corporation shall be managed by a board of seven directors. The charter says the corporation with all powers and rights that pertain to corporations. In my view, this is the classic case where you've got a bequest. Our trustees. The trustees take the corpus of the trust, and with instructions, they set up a corporation, in this case to operate a college. The corpus then goes to the college. It fully vests in the college. And the trust, the purpose of it is accomplished. What the trustees are supposed to do is accomplished, and the trust terminates.
But again, this is a preliminary injunction. It's a status quo injunction. It's not a final merits hearing on anything. And the analysis on the merits is simply, for lack of a better phrase, reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. So if we were to rule on law, it would not be the ultimate ruling on any particular point unless we said it was. So it seems to me part of your argument is really just, I have a winning argument when we finally get the trial. Perhaps you do. But that's not something we should decide today, should it?
This is, whether there is a viable cause of action based on the fact that there's an allegation this is a corporation. This is a legal assessment. This is not a factual assessment. They admit that this is a corporation. They're saying under the language of the will and the charter, which is for Your Honors to...
And we know for sure there'll never be any extrinsic evidence produced at some point later in the proceedings?
I guess you can't absolutely say that, but I don't know what extrinsic evidence there would be from a will that was done back in just around 1900. And Your Honor, I guess when you look at the relief they're asking for here, and that's part of the issue we have, there has never been a hearing, never an evidentiary hearing dealing with the Virginia Uniform Trust Code. It was dismissed. It was not considered on the April 15th hearing. It was not addressed in the order that deals with the temporary injunction.
But the question Justice Mims asked you earlier is, it doesn't seem procedurally right. Sorry, Millett.
It doesn't matter.
Your apology. Given as well. The point is that it doesn't seem right that a trial court on a pleadings ruling can abort the issue forever for purposes of a status quo injunction. If that is the law, you would need to present it to us because it's not intuitive. It doesn't seem procedurally, there's no symmetry to that. You can get it even though you can get a post-judgment status quo injunction and a supersedis bond. But you can't get it if you get shot down at the pleading stage and there's a year and a half between that and time of trial. It just doesn't seem logical.
My point, Your Honor, was that there has been no evidence presented under count two. How can you grant any relief to either side?
Well, let me ask it to you a different way then. Let's say that we find that there's irreparable harm that could be accomplished if, in fact, we proceed as the trial court's proceeding now and allowing you to use the business judgment rule and make decisions about this entity, when, in fact, later on we determine that, in fact, it is a trust and it should have been controlled by a Cypre analysis. That could be irreparable harm by allowing the trust, the institute, to go forward now without some protection.
So there would be entry of injunctive relief based on what evidence?
On the irreparable harm that could flow based upon what we've seen already about the pleadings.
So under count one?
Could be under count two also. Well, you're right, it wouldn't be under count two.
What I'm saying is it can't be under that. So you have count one. And then the question is, can you give the injunctive relief that's been requested under count one? And the problem with that is count one is very narrow. It deals with solicitations of funds, but not all funds. What we're talking about is...
Well, make it see where you're going. Are you saying then we can't even consider the allegations in count two in deciding whether there's irreparable harm or not?
I don't know how you can. They've been dismissed with prejudice and they not have been properly appealed.
But that's the trial court's view.
Understood.
This court has not decided the likelihood of the success on the merits on any subject. So how can a trial court unilaterally shut down a preliminary injunction consideration by an appellate court on likelihood of success on the merits by telling us, I don't think there's any merit to it at all?
All right, well, let me go to bigger picture then. The relief that is being requested, no matter whether you look at it under the trust code or whether you look at it under the SCA, is going to completely gut the business judgment rule. What they're asking you to do is not just deal with the assets and what may be spent one way or another way. They're asking you to take over the complete governance of the school, the operations of the school. They're asking you to enjoin the Attorney General from going through the MIFA process. You're asking the school to be enjoined from being able to use funds that are donated specifically for the purpose of closing or released under MIFA or some other process for the specific use of closing. You're saying that a corporation, and this is clearly a non-stock corporation under 13.1826, has no right to carry out the functions that are specifically given to the college by the statute.
But isn't that what status quo injunctions do for a temporary period of time until the court can hear the merits?
It is the status quo. First of all, there isn't really a status quo. I mean, you can't freeze this. The world goes on.
You're asking to operate the school.
We're spending money. As a practical matter, letting the school go forward and not having an orderly wind down as we're planning, I would suggest we'll close the school sooner. I would suggest that our bondholders, without the thought that there's going to be a orderly wind down, will be in the mix very shortly.
Well, why are you contesting this so strongly if that's the case?
Excuse me?
Why are you contesting this so strongly?
I'm not contesting so strongly the closing of the school. I think the board made the right decision. What I'm contesting is the right of the board to make this decision and not to have the county attorney or the judiciary to intervene and say, well, we disagree with the outcome. That is not really the place without evidence of willful misconduct or dishonesty. You can't step in and say, corporation, we didn't like what you're going to do it, so we're going to flip it over. We're going to have a fiduciary come in and we're going to run it because we don't like the decision you made. I understand how in the circumstance of Sweetbriar.
I'm sorry to say that, but that sounds like an overstatement. This is just a preliminary injunction. This is not a final injunction. This is not a ruling on the ultimate merits. It's a preliminary injunction. It's issued all the time by courts. And it freezes the situation until the court can give it a really hard and deliberative look on the merits. That's different, isn't it?
I don't think so under these circumstances because of the time frame. I think you're looking at a situation that there is a real practical impact to the decision that the court makes. And you're not really asked to be granting an injunction so much from a practical standpoint as you're being asked to either allow for a orderly wind down or you're being asked to allow a crash and burn.
Well, I think the third option is being allowed to allow the Cypre to come in and maintain the purpose of the trust, that there be a woman's school in perpetuity of some sort. Maybe it would be different, look different than Sweetbriar, but that's certainly something that a trial court could do under the Cypre doctrine, couldn't it?
I don't think that is, I think that has to go through a different process. I think the school can close without changing, without making a decision about whether we're going to a women's school or a co-ed school. Under the law of Virginia 13.1826, we have the right to cease operations. We're not trying to dissolve. You would then get to how those assets are going to be used, and there is a process that you would go through the AG and through the courts to determine how it is that you would move forward from that point. Whether it be reopening the school, whether it be sending the funds to a foundation for scholarships, I think that all is a later process.
But if the Institute is a trust, and I know you're resting on the declaration that it is a corporation and the two can't exist. Suppose we disagree with you and it is a trust. How can you cease the operations of the school when it is presumably under the terms of the trust to be operated in perpetuity?
It is to be operated in the best interest of the beneficiaries, correct?
I mean, let's get this straight. I ask questions.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I think that what the step would be is if you have a trustee, and I disagree, I don't think there's any way this college can be a trustee and a corporation. I think that what you have to look at.
Well, there are three very well-recognized and respected professors of trusts and estates that disagree with you rather vehemently in this case, so there must be a reasonable view on the other side.
I don't doubt there's a reasonable view on the other side, Your Honor, but I don't see how, considering the duties of a trustee versus the duties of a board of directors of a corporation, they're just in conflict. If you've only got, and could a college be a trustee? Sure it could. A college could be a trustee. You have the trust instruments, they have the legal title. Here the legal and equitable title have come together, they've merged, and you do have a situation where you the same assets, the trust assets, are also the college assets. And you can't have that.
Well, isn't that precisely the problem in the case? If you're not correct, and a trustee can also be a corporation, it seems to me that will affect the manner in which dissolution would occur. You wouldn't be simply able to use the corporate law. You'd have to use the corporate law and trust law in order to comply with both requirements to, I suspect, terminate the school and to dissolve the school.
Yes, sir, that is absolutely correct. And our point is, if you look at that from a practical standpoint, you're not going to be able to do it because how do we even identify who the beneficiaries are? And once you identify the beneficiaries, there are going to be people in different classes of beneficiaries who have different views on whether the school should continue or not continue. And then you have to balance that versus what is in the best interest of the corporation. You're asking the board of directors and their governance to do something that I believe is impossible.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Hurd?
Briefly, to respond to opposing counsel, there's no evidence here that the school would crash and burn. if it were not closed down by them. Our brief, pages 4-5, lay out the highlights of the evidence we produced at the hearing to show this is a financially viable operation. It needs to be adjusted here or there, but this is a college that was, its assets, for example, in June of 2014, its net assets were more than its net assets a year earlier, a $95 million endowment. The per student endowment, $134,000, about the same as Hampton Sydney's, more than Randolph-Macon's and Ashland. The problem is they haven't run it right. They haven't had a director of admissions. They haven't had a director of development. They didn't even tell their alumni that they thought the college was in trouble. So no wonder, if you don't have a message and you don't have a messenger, you're not going to raise much money. Even so, their net assets increased.
Mr. Hurd, may I ask one last question? Can you explain to me why, under your best theory, the right result here is we issue an opinion on the law and what we understand the law to be, and then we remand it to the trial court for expedited hearings on whether there's a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits given the facts of the case, which we're not going to involve ourselves in at the level that the trial court would, and the other equitable variables. And there are many variables. They're not susceptible to an appellate de novo review. Why isn't that a reasonable and correct legal response to your argument?
Well, Your Honor, my response would be, due to the urgency of time, that this court should take it upon itself to issue the injunction. Now, if they want to go back and show the trial court some facts that let them escape the injunction, that's something else. But we need immediate action if we're going to have a chance to save this college. With respect to enjoining the Attorney General, we're not trying to enjoin the Attorney General. They're trying to tie the Attorney General's hands in the hands of the courts by creating a fait accompli by destroying the college by orphaning the funds that they know they cannot use for another purpose directly. But if they kill the college, if they open the funds, then their plan is, well, of course the court will then have to approve the diversion that otherwise would have been illegal. That's why the trial court erred when it said it did not have the authority to stop closing of the college. That is an act in furtherance of a violation of the Charitable Solicitations Act. That is their orphan fund strategy, and it should be enjoined. We thank your honors for your time this morning and ask you to grant the relief we requested.
The court is adjourned.
All rise.